honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors, and presented everywhere, on the air and online, by the U.S. Army. Find your place on the Army team at goarmy.com/warriors.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, where every single time we pick up a unique perspective on World War II through the eyes of Americans who participated. I don't think you expected to hear about U.S. activity in Vietnam during World War II, or even America's first casualty in Vietnam, nearly 30 years before the Vietnam War was over. You won't find the name of A. Peter Dewey on the Vietnam Veterans Memorial Wall in Washington, D.C., because the Defense Department has ruled that war did not begin for the U.S. in Vietnam until November 1955, after the fall of Dien Bien Phu. But Dewey was killed there a decade before that. It was September 26, 1945. And as I'm pretty sure you can tell, our guest today, George Wicks, remembers that time period with incredible clarity.
Peter Dewey was supposed to go home. He, in those days, at the end of the war, if you had enough points, as they called it, enough years, days, actions, whatever, overseas service, you were released for a discharge. He was supposed to go home on a particular day, and the plane didn't turn up in time. So we drove cross-country from the airport to the villa where OSS guys were living, through a roadblock, and by this time there'd been skirmishing on the outskirts of Saigon, and the Vietnamese were armed, through a roadblock which was manned by Vietnamese, armed Vietnamese. Going through this roadblock, Peter Dewey yelled something in French at the Vietnamese. Now, one of our officers had been wounded the night before, and he had just visited that man in the hospital. He may have yelled something. The officer who was riding with him didn't understand French, so he doesn't know what Peter said. Well, the Vietnamese reaction was they had a machine gun, and they killed him, shot his head off. The Jeep overturned, and it's only incredible luck and some skill that allowed Dewey's second-in-command, Blücher, to get to the villa. He was, I don't know the exact distance. Some accounts is 500 yards. I doubt that he would have sprinted 500 yards. He happened to be that thing, which I am not at all, a crack shot with a 45. And he had one, of course, as an officer. So he made it. Then we were, you know, we had a firefight on our hands for several hours. We were able to drive off the attackers. And finally, they raised a white flag. They wanted to collect their injured and casual, they wanted to collect their casualties and retire from the field. There were only three of us shooting, I think. But we were trained soldiers. And we were using the weapons we'd been trained with, you know. A carbine looks like a nice little thing. I don't know if you've ever fired one, but it's very effective. You don't need a major weapon in a firefight like that. The Vietnamese were not trained as soldiers. They were just a bunch of guys who were opposing French occupation of their country.
By the same token, Master of the Obvious here says your life was in severe danger in that moment. Is that something you lived with all the time or that you had to be prepared for? When a situation like that actually comes up, what's that like to be a part of it?
From the time I went into the Army, and I think this is probably true of many of us, I wondered, first of all, if I was going to survive this war, and then what I would do in combat. This was my only experience of combat. I had been in dangerous situations, but not in actual gunfight. And when it happened, I knew exactly what I had to do. You know, I went up to the front of the property, lay down on the ground with my carbine, enough ammunition. It was natural. It was sort of almost, I won't say instinctive. It was, I thought it out, and I thought the front of the property is the best place to be. You see most clearly, and lying down on the ground, you don't have the problem of unsteady hands shaking or whatever. So the three of us were able to drive off, I don't know how many attackers, but a number, considerable number, and they had pretty heavy casualties, and finally called it off.
And then did you have to get out of there after that because of what had happened?
When the attack began, the officer in charge wanted to send the message to us. Our radio communication was always with OSS headquarters in Ceylon. The broadcasts were made at fixed times and always in code, but in this case, couldn't meet the schedule. they decided, I was not a part of this since I was down there on the ground shooting, but decided not to send messages and couldn't send messages. I was a code guy, so there was nobody to encode the messages. And anyhow, send them in the clear and don't try to raise Ceylon because it's not the time they're listening. So send it to the British instead. And the British sent out a troop of Gurkha, a squad of Gurkhas who appeared, but all the action was over by the time they arrived. One of our officers and a French officer who happened to have been there for lunch that day, but he'd also been in the OSS, interestingly enough. He'd been living in Washington, and he joined the OSS first and then later transferred to the French Army. They went and met with the Vietnamese. They wanted to get the Jeep and Dewey's body. Well, both had disappeared and were never found again.
Well, and you're qualified to say that because you were one of the ones searching for him, right?
One of my jobs, subsequently, one of my assignments was examining grisly remains to see if they were Peter Dewey. So we did that for a time. My point is that Frank White, this same guy I went to Hanoi with, and the French officer, Valjean, were perfectly safe by then. You know, I give them a lot of credit for going out there and meeting with the Vietnamese after we had been shooting at each other for several hours. But we could have gone back to town. There wasn't any problem. We would have taken the regular road back to town. We wouldn't have gone through the roadblock. So the Gurkhas didn't save us, but they made us more comfortable.
And what about the emotional impact? Because here's a guy who has been your boss, and now he's gone. How did that hit you as a young man far away from home?
Peter and I were quite close. We used to speak French to each other, which none of the other guys did. We had a kind of standing joke. I would greet him in French as mon colonel, and he would greet me as mon lieutenant. He talked to me quite a bit. Well, for one thing, he told me all about what he was picking up in the way of intelligence. And it was very interesting because he was an old hand, and he was very experienced, had terrific connections, and, as I said, spoke faultless French and got around. In fact, that's why he was being sent away. The British didn't like the fact that he was meeting with the Vietnamese, particularly Vietnamese active in the independence movement. He talked to me a lot about personal things. You know, what was I going to do after the war? He was thinking of a career in foreign service. I've always thought if Peter Dewey had lived, I would have gone into the foreign service. So I was quite moved by his death. I felt it personally. This was a friend. This was someone I knew quite well and saw on a daily basis for, it had been 3 months we'd been together then.
And did his death affect at all your view of your own life and death or your own future if you were going to continue with the OSS or this intelligence work?
I didn't think I was in any danger after that. I mean, once we got back to the Continental Hotel in the center of Saigon, we went on with our radio communications, and the radio operator and I had our own little place in the annex next to this very sinister character who owned the hotel, Frank Heaney. He was a Corsican who was in the opium business, and he was very friendly. He was always friendly with me because I spoke French. The radio operator didn't. He always invited me to come in and have a pipe with him. It was a real sort of Graham Greene operation, you know. And Graham Greene, when he came to Saigon, soon met up with Frank Heaney and talked with him for hours, fascinated by this man who knew all kinds of underground things, you know, the opium trade and whatnot.
And I'm sorry if any of my questions border on cliche or a generic view or interpretation of things, but did you ever feel like the man who knew too much or could end up knowing too much because of some of these circles you were running in or the things you were exposed to?
I can answer that with a rather melodramatic bit of information. When I went back to Saigon on that tramp steamer, I learned that I'd had a price on my head. Peter Dewey and I had been marked by the French colonials. They knew we were meeting with the Vietnamese, and I didn't explain that. Peter met with some of the leaders of the Vietnamese independence movement. And since he was well known, he decided he couldn't always meet with them, and he asked me to go and have some of these clandestine meetings because I could speak French with them. They all spoke French. They were all educated men. And two or three times I would get dressed. There were lots of POWs floating around town, mostly Dutch, who hadn't been repatriated yet. And they all wore khakis but with baggy shorts. So I dressed up like a Dutch POW and in order to walk the streets where I wouldn't be seen. Well, the French obviously were on to us, and that's why they had put a price on Peter's head and mine. And they were not very well informed, however. The description of me was really a description of Peter Dewey. He was about 6 inches shorter than me and slightly bald.
Well, accuracy is everything, and in that case, that worked in your favor. Well, I'm sure there came a point where you had a decision to make. Are you going to continue with the OSS as it morphs into the CIA, or are you going to choose another path for your life? How did that unfold, and why did you make the choice that you made?
Well, the decision was partly made by the Army. The Army decided we don't need this OSS anymore. They didn't like OSS anymore, anyhow, regular Army. MacArthur wouldn't allow them to be in the Pacific, for instance. Well, they were a little too independent, and OSS always broke the rules, you know. For instance, promoting everybody, or Dewey became a colonel overnight, and I became a lieutenant. This is, and one of the great things about OSS was how imaginative it was in its operations. For instance, the Navy SEALs were conceived by OSS. OSS had the idea of training swimmers to go into enemy harbors and pinning what they call limpets to the bottom of ships, blowing them up. There were a lot of operations. I never had anything to do with the operational side of OSS, but they were very clever at devising all kinds of tactics.
So the OSS was coming to an end, but the CIA was being born. And you probably could have had an opportunity to pursue that, right?
Oh, they approached me. They wanted me to join the CIA. I didn't want to join the CIA. I had a couple of opportunities. One was a job in the State Department, actually. Sort of a, you know, low-rank job, but still it would have been a beginning. But after Peter's death, I decided I don't want to pursue career in foreign service. I wanted to go back to graduate school, study English some more.
Well, I get the sense that you're pretty pleased you took that route.
Oh, yes. I've had a lovely academic career.
How long have you been teaching now?
60 years, full time. But I was invited to quit several years ago. My wife and I were both teaching, and we were both invited to quit because we were drawing students away from the real faculty.
I know it's hard to summarize that many years in a short thought, but what have been the highlights for you? I mean, I'm sure you've lost count of all the students you've had and the classes you've taught and the literature you've covered, but what are some of the things that you look back on and you say, I'm really thankful or proud of being a part of this?
It's hard to single anything out. One of the most remarkable things in my academic career was starting a new college. I was one of the 7 founding faculty members of Harvey Mudd College in Claremont, California. That was an experience. I was in Claremont for 12 years. I loved it there, but then the smog got to me. And I was invited to come here. The day I arrived in Oregon, I knew this was the place for me. I was allowed to teach anything I wanted. What more can you ask for? And I like to teach lots of things. You know, I started out in the Renaissance and ended up in the 20th century, but along the way, I've taught all kinds of things. And it's been a wonderful teaching experience here.
How about this hypothetical? If you were stuck in one place and you couldn't leave, an island, the forest, wherever, and you could only have one piece of literature with you to keep you company, what would it be?
Complete works of Shakespeare. You can spend a life on that without any trouble. One of the guys I went overseas with built himself a wooden box so that he could carry the works of Shakespeare with him overseas. He was a big, strong guy. It was really an excessive burden. You're always burdened in the Army as it is. Not him. He took that, and he was in the message center in Calcutta at the same time I was. And he got night duty so he could read all night because there was not much going on at night. He volunteered to work at night.
Here's the gold medal right here. So the Congressional Gold Medal, the highest award that is given to civilians in our country, and it's given to the OSS. What was your reaction when you heard that news? Had you ever thought that something like that might happen for you, or that people even remembered what the OSS was?
Well, it wasn't given to me. It was given to the organization, and I felt the organization was certainly deserving of a gold medal for what it did to the war effort. Made a major contribution. Now, you've mentioned yourself that OSS is not very well known, but it was tremendously important. OSS was very active in the war effort in many ways, very ingenious, very independent. It was everything the army was not. The organized military were really a kind of bureaucracy with very fixed rules, and they were not as free and easy in their thinking. And OSS broke all those rules. And in doing so, they succeeded where the army was often sort of stuck in the mud. And I think the organization, for all the things it did, for all of the daring deeds and all of the strategic intelligence it gathered, certainly deserved the gold medal. I don't feel proud. I feel grateful. I had a wonderful experience. I had a wonderful war. I was extremely fortunate. And, you know, there were parts of it that were not pleasant, obviously, but I had a terrific time and a fascinating time.
And it has been a fascinating hour with 96-year-old George Wicks of Eugene, Oregon. Don't forget to check out that video of the professor explaining the artwork on the OSS Congressional Gold Medal. You can find that at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. You know, he still teaches the occasional Insight Seminar in Eugene, and he certainly educated all of us on a few things we wouldn't have found anywhere else today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by the U.S. Army, building a new generation of leaders at goarmy.com/warriors.